The second Aliyah of Shmini is a fascinating exercise in our benefits from focusing on one Aliyah, because this is not an Aliyah that would get a lot of attention in the normal course of events, because there's so much else going on in Shmini, both in terms of the drama and in terms of the practical halacha of kashrus and the like. And one would not necessarily direct focus towards this very brief second Aliyah. But, as we'll see in the next few minutes, Baz Hashem, there is more than meets the eye. There is quite a lot that emerges from these psukim. So to begin with, these psukim, which are continuing the description of the order here on the eighth day of the Miluim to inaugurate the Mishkan. So the pasuk begins, this is Parakes, pasuk Yizayin, Vayakrev, Esna Mincha, V'yamali Chapulimena, V'yakter Olamizbeach, Milvad Olas Habokim. So here, Aaron brings the Mincha. So once again, we have a Sheni that's talking about Mincha, and he fills up his hand. And the idea of filling up the hand, the Taurus Kohanim points out that it has to only have the substance in it, and any other foreign matter would create a problem, would tassle. And the Taurus Kohanim explains that since it's taking up space, so that creates a situation of chaser, that it means that part of what needs to be there is missing. And this is an indication that it has the same standard of requirements as we find by other menachos. So the menachos, where we're told that everything that is included within his hand is a part of the mincha, and that's all necessary in order for it to count. It's a discussion in the Gemara, and Gemara Maseches Yuma, about what about what's in between the fingernails. And the Gemara has a very interesting statement there that the substance in between the fingers is a suffix, and the way it's phrased, the Gemara suggests that it was paskined as a suffix, which is hard to understand. A suffix is something that we normally use to refer to what we don't know. So how can we say that, oh, we don't know the answer, and then it came, we responded, it's a suffix. And the Ritva has a comment on that Gemara in Yuma, that this is similar to Ben Hashmashos, which we've had a chance to talk about a little bit this year. It harkens back to the beginning of the Masechta, where the topic of Ben Hashmashos was a discussion. So we treat Ben Hashmashos as a suffix, and the Ritva says, based on this comparison, what we mean is, not just that we don't know, it means that it's inherently a suffix. It's something that is mysterious. It's the twilight zone. So here we have this requirement that we define the mincha based on what's in the hand. And if anything else is in there, so then that's going to take away from what needs to be there, and that's going to be considered a chisaron. So we see this as the normal standards for all the menachos. But the Gemara does say, in Daf Tes, in the days of Masechas Menachos, that the difference is that here it was filled up in the right hand, while other menachos would be in the left hand. And the Torah Tumim explains about that, that normally when it comes to mitzvos in general, so we have a idea of showing kavod to the yamin, to the right side, but in the context of the mitzvah, let's say, so there the ma'aseh haktara is taking place with the right, so you fill it up with the left hand to serve that. But here, the filling up is the mitzvah, so therefore that happens in the right hand. Okay, so then the pasuk concludes, Milvad Olas Habokeh. It sounds like it means, as the Ramban understands, that they were bringing the regular tmidim. And Hirsch has a discussion about this also, where he notes that the karbanos of the eighth day were like musaf, like a carbon musaf. And just like on Yantif, you have musaf, but you also have the regular tfilos. So that's a crucial part of every day, that we have our basic acknowledgments of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and whatever is extra is on top of that. So too, that was the case also in this eighth day, that they were bringing the other karbanos as well, they were bringing the tmidim as well, and this is on top of that. That's how the Ramban understands, and that's what Rav Hirsch was commenting in a similar vein. However, There are those who seem to disagree. From some of the Rishonim, it doesn't sound like that, that they weren't bringing the Tzmidim. And then that poses the question, as Rav Dustin Gestetner, in his Sefer Baharas Nassan on Chumash, discusses, if they weren't bringing the Tzmidim, so that's necessary for the Chinuch HaMizbeach to inaugurate, what the Gemara says, that in order to inaugurate the Mizbeach, they're going to need to bring the Tzmidim. So how could they be using the Mizbeach without having brought the carbon Tzmidim as part of the Chinuch? So he suggests there that maybe it was not yet functioning in its status as the Mizbeach. Maybe it was functioning as a Bama. We know that once upon a time, it used to be permissible to have a private Mizbeach that you could bring Korbanos on. And perhaps that was the function until this point. It was still functioning like a Bama. It wasn't going to be actually inaugurated as the Mizbeach until later. Okay, could be. So on the next Pasuk, so following this, Pasuk Yidches, we have the Shlomim. So Yishachat es ha'ashor, yes ha'oyel, nezabach ha'shlomim, asher la'am, v'yamtiyu b'nei Aaron, es ha'adam e'lov, v'yizrikeyu ol mizbeach sotis. So then they check to the shore in the aisle as the shlomim, and Aaron's sons brought him the dam, and he put it on, he threw it on the mizbeach. So it's interesting, as the Shachach would comment, that the mincha comes before the shlomim, because the Gemara says in Zvachim and Das Peites that normally minei damim, the animals with blood, normally come before minachos. So he suggests what's going on here is that since the mincha is at least sometimes brought to tzibur, and a korban shlamim is not brought to tzibur, so therefore that which is at least on some level connected to the tzibur, that connects it to the idea of tedirus, of that which is more common, and since we have this general prioritization of that tadir tadir kodem, that we prioritize that which is more common, so therefore we see that flowing here as well. Okay, so then Sukkim continue. V'yasa chalavim min ha'shor, min ha'ayo ha'aya, v'ha'machaseh, v'ha'kloyos, v'yaseres ha'kaveh. So they have different parts of the animal, including the forbidden fat. And the next pasuk says, v'yasimu v'yasa chalavim ala chazos, v'yakter ha'chalavim mizbecha. So they put the chalavim on top of the chazos, on top of the breast pieces, the actor ha'chalavim ha'mizbecha, and then they turned that all into smoke. So there's a couple of interesting things that emerge from this pasuk. First of all, the language here of yasimu and then v'yakter. So it starts off plural, and then it ends up singular. So the Gemara Menachos and Daf Samach Beis points out that this is to show that they needed three Kohanim to be involved in this whole process, and that this is a reflection of the idea of Berov Am Hadras Melech, that Kadosh Baruch Hu gets more glory when more people are involved. So therefore they had three Kohanim doing this. And the Sefer Mital HaShamayim, he points out that it's just interesting, if you pay attention, that this idea of Berov Am Hadras Melech seems to apply in different ways, in different contexts, in slightly opposite ways. Because sometimes we say, Berov Am Hadras Melech, that you have actually fewer people doing the mitzvah, that instead of having everyone do a mitzvah by themselves, you would gather a group together and have one person do the mitzvah and be motzi everyone else, and that that's better because the people are gathered together as one. And it results in fewer people actually performing the mitzvah, but the mitzvah takes place in a crowd. So that's considered to be Berov Am. And here we find a different kind of application, which is a little bit the opposite, that by getting more people involved in the action, that's Berov Am. So apparently it's the same idea applied in different ways, that the notion of getting more people involved, sometimes it means actually having fewer people perform it so that they could all do it together. And sometimes if it's something that's just happening once, so then the way of getting more people involved is to have more people brought into the performance. So it's all towards the same goal. And it's an interesting observation that in order to bring about that goal, sometimes we have to go in opposite directions. But what is also very significant in Hilchus Kashrus, this whole parsha, is known for its relevance to Hilchos Kashrus in the later part of the Parsha, where we find out about all of the different animals and what's kosher and what's not. So in this pasuk, there is an important ramification for Yoredeya, for Hilchos Kashrus, because the pasuk said, as we just saw, that they took the chalavim, which has forbidden fats, and they put it on top of the chazos. So the Gemara Maseches Chulin, and this is in the first parak, we saw this last year, those who were with us last year, we were learning the first parak of Chulin, the Gemara and Daf Ches Amud Beis talks about not putting the flanks of the meat on top of the, with the chalavim, with fat in it, on top of the kosher meat, because of the concern that the fat is going to liquefy and is going to seep into the kosher meat. So you're going to end up tracing up your meat. So you should not put the fat on top of the kosher meat. So Tosus over there comments that it must be that it's sometimes mutter, because we see here from the pasuk that that's what was happening. So when the Gemara says not to do it, it must mean that when it's still hot, then we have to worry that one is going to seep into the other. But after it cools down, so then it's permissible to do, and that's what we see from this pasuk. The Rashba over there quotes the language of the Rambam, so it sounds like from the Rambam that this is only a din of uchasila, because really you could just wipe it off afterwards, but we're just concerned that maybe you won't, and that's the problem. And the Rashba himself, he says, it really sounds like it's b'dievik, because it sounds like from the Gemara that we're worried it's going to be absorbed in, and that maybe it won't be enough just to wipe it off. You'll have to remove that part. So that's one issue where this pasuk is invoked as influencing the path of the halacha here, and it comes up again in Kalabasar. So those who were this last year, so you learned this Gemara also, so a little double Chazara synergy, one Gemara from the first parak and one Gemara from Kalabasar. We saw both these Gemaras last year. But the Mishnah and the Gemara and Daf Kuf Zayin Amud Beis, there the Mishnah talks about not putting Isser and Heter next to each other, touching each other. And the Gemara says that even if it's cold, so why should that be an issue of transferring taste? And the Gemara says, because we have to make sure that we will still wipe it off, so the parts shouldn't merge with each other. So the Baal HaItter over there writes that this is only a concern when it's cooked. But if they're raw, then it's not a worry that they're going to merge with each other. But the Ra'ah, so he understood that it doesn't matter whether it's cooked or it's raw, it's also no matter what. So here the Rashba then comes in the Mishmaris Habayis and he says, once again, look at this pasuk, look at Parsha Shmini, where we find that they did it. So it must be that there's a situation where it's mutter. So this is similar to the Tosfos in the first part. They're both pointing to this pasuk to say that there must be a situation where it's mutter, because here we see it happening. So the Isser can't be absolute. So in terms of putting the fats on top of the meat, so it must be, that's what Tosa said, it must be an issue only when it's hot. And here when the Gemara talks about putting them next to each other, so that's where the Rashba says it must be only when they are cooked, because we see that here the Pasuk tells us it could happen. So the Vilna Gaon, commenting on that, he says he doesn't understand the Rashba or Tosa apparently, because the Pasuk doesn't necessarily have anything to do with his din. This din would presumably be a din d'rabbanan, and ben haTorah, it would be mutter. So to show that it happens in this parsha, to show that the pasuk allows it, that doesn't indicate anything about the issur d'rabbanan. And as he notes, even nowadays, the issur d'rabbanan, if we had the Beit HaMikdash functioning, it wouldn't apply in that context, because we say kohanim's reason hangs. So we normally don't have prohibitions midrabbanan that apply in the Beit HaMikdash. So it's apples and oranges. You can't look to this pasuk to tell us anything about the halachos of your kitchen, because we're dealing with drabbanan, and that doesn't apply in this context. So as some of the latest svarim point out, that there's a discussion about this in the Sefer Chavatah with Hashanah HaTorah, and also my friend Shlomo Sinneman talks about this in his recent Sefer Ishtamid in Vayikra, that presumably Tosfos' point is consistent with what they attribute to the Taz. The Taz in a few places has a comment that's so well known that Rav David Cohen had a whole Sefer about this. He refers to it as the famous Taz, the famous position of the Taz, that the Torah, if the Torah permits something, so then Chazal don't come and prohibit something that the Torah is explicit about its permissibility. When the rabbis add Yisurim, they add Yisurim to things that are not covered and not explicitly in the Torah. The Torah doesn't explicitly say one way or another, so by default, if you look at it, the rabbis can come and prohibit it. But if there's something the Torah explicitly talks about as being mutter, so then the Taz, and probably many before him and after him, understood that the Torah is not going to come and prohibit that. So that's maybe Tosfos' point, that we see that the Torah explicitly discusses it as being mutter, so that's going to be relevant even to an Issa Drabanan. How can you have an Issa Drabanan if the Torah says that it's mutter? So how do you answer that question then? So that does seem to be an issue, or at least an issue for the Taz's principle, and this is something the Chavetz Chaim talks about a little bit more. And he notes that you have to understand why the Taz says what he says. So one explanation, this is where Reshefta often explains it also, is that if we understand that the rabbis are empowered to interpret the intent of the Torah and to protect the Torah based on its intent, so then they can fill in the blanks, but they're not going to suggest something and require something that's going to contradict the words of the Torah. It's not going to be able to now be a new combined entity, as Reshefta puts it, of Tarash Shebichsav and Tarash Shebalpeh. It's going to be incompatible. There are going to be contradictions between the Tarash Shebichsav and the Tarash Shebalpeh. So how does that create a space here? So the way the Chavetz Chaim says is, it may mean that Chazal cannot be gozer something, but they can focus on a certain specific concern. So I think what he means, maybe a slightly different way to say it, is that if Chazal are trying to tell you that this is the intent of the Torah, so then it's contradicted by the fact that the Torah explicitly says a different way. But if we're suggesting a policy, basically, we're saying that, listen, if you're going to do this, you're going to end up in a bad situation because you're going to forget to clean it off, or you're going to have some kind of a combination that's going to be challenging or more than that to separate, so then that's more of a policy type of consideration, and maybe it is possible that that doesn't create the same kind of problem. We know that the Torah is telling us that it was possible, but we're saying that as a matter of policy, it's not something that should be done. Okay, so there's a lot of practicality that emerges from this pasuk. So this pasuk, which maybe you didn't pay too much attention to, didn't think has necessarily so much significance for our lives, so we see that it's relevant to the broad concept of Rovam Hadras Melach, and it's also relevant to some practicalities in Hilchos Kashrus, both in terms of the process post-shechita and in terms of the storage of food in the kitchen. And it's also relevant to this broader idea of something that the Torah explicitly permits, and how does that interact with any potential dinim derabanan. So who knew how many concepts, how many principles would emerge from this one short pasuk. Okay, so to continue, so then the Torah talks about the tnufa. And Pasuk Chavala says, V'yasa chazos, v'yeis ashoka yamin, heinif aron tnufos ne Hashem, kasher tziva Moshe. So they waved all of these pieces together. So as Rav Hirsch comments, that this actually happened before the Ketores, the waving. So why is it mentioned here after the Ketores? So he understands that the Torah is placing it here in order to connect it to the pasuk afterwards, which talks about the bracha, which we will discuss in a moment. And it's in order to create that connection, that the whole offering of the Chazav Ashok, as Rav Hirsch comments elsewhere, is about showing that all of what we receive in this world and all of our aspirations and all of our potential and all of our spiritual gifts are directed towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they all come from the brachos. Therefore, we want to have a juxtaposition of this imagery together with the bracha that comes afterwards. So what bracha is that exactly? So if we look at the next pasuk, Chavez, Vayisa Aaron Ethiodov, El Ha'am, Vayvarchein, Vayyere Me'asos Vachatas, Vaha'ola Vahashlamen. So Aaron lifted up his hands, and he blessed the people. So what bracha is that? So Aaron HaKohen lifting up his hands and blessing the people. What bracha does that sound like? So it sounds like it's Brachas Kohanim. We got a Kohen lifting up his hands and giving the bracha. It seems to be what's going on. And that's how Rashi understands. That's also the Yerushalmi. In the beginning of the fourth Parak HaTainus, that this was an instance of Brachas Kohanim. The Ramban, his commentary here, he's not so sure if that's really what we're talking about here. Brachas Kohanim we read about in Parshas Noso. Is that commanded yet? He wasn't so sure. He says, maybe this is just the idea of Aaron praying to Hashem without necessarily blessing the people. We find something similar with Shlomo HaMelech and Melachim Aleph. Or maybe it was just a one-time thing. Maybe this isn't necessarily connected to the general mitzvah of Brachas Kohanim. And the Sefer Meichain, he quotes from the Reishis Bikurim of Rabbi Tzala Kohen of Vilna, who asked the question that if this was Brachas Kohanim, so why weren't Aaron's sons also involved? So according to the Ramban's alternative approaches, so we understand, okay, it's just something Aaron was doing. But if you say, like Rashi, and you say this really was Brachas Kohanim, okay, so then we imagine that his sons would also be a part of it. So one suggestion he has is that this was a part of the chinuch here, not the chinuch both ways, chinuch of involving children, but also the chinuch of the inauguration of the Mishkan, that now Brachas Kohanim is also being broken in, so to speak, is also being inaugurated. So from here on in, so the other Kohanim will also be involved. But Aaron HaKohen is doing this first act of Brachas Kohanim in order to be mechanech it, in order to inaugurate it. The Zayin LaTorah, the Lutzke Rav, suggests that maybe the sons aren't mentioned here because maybe they were between the age of 13 and 20. And it sounds like from the Gemara in Chulin and the Rambam in Hilchos Tevila that you have to be Nesmali Zikno from the Tzias Kapayim. Now, Lamaiso, we do see that Ketanim go up also, but maybe according to that approach, the Ketanim don't go up because the mitzvah itself, they go to add to the music with Sumei Kala, they go to enhance the experience. Maybe that's according to that, not the actual bit. That's a discussion of how exactly it fits in. But the idea that we are talking about Berachas Kohanim here, so it's supported by Rashi and the Rishalmi, and also the Babli, because the Gemara in Masechta Sota, where many of the dinim of Berachas Kohanim appear, Lamechas Bar Aleph and around there, so the Gemara learns out the number of dinim from here about Berachas Kohanim. And so this idea of lifting the hand, so the Gemara says, that's how you know that we need Nesias Kapayim. That's what we call Berachas Kohanim. We call it Nesias Kapayim. We call it the lifting up of the hands. So we know that it needs that from this pasuk. And Maram Shik was one of the great students of the Chasam Sofer. The Maram Shik in his drashas, he explains that the reason we need Nesias Kapayim is because we have to point to where all the brachos come from. We have to show that everything that we have comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so the hands are pointed klapei mala. It's interesting in general that the whole notion of Berachas Kohanim, which primarily sourced in Parshas Nasa, but here we see this possible invoking of it, that the whole idea of Berachas Kohanim, which has many fascinating details to explore, and the whole discussion in the Achronim, what is it? Is it a type of tefillah or is it a type of avoda? How exactly does it fit in? And you could say that really it's its own model, it's its own din in the Torah with its own scope, and it seems to be that it's really a dramatic presentation, that there's a lot of focus on the visuals and a lot of focus on the symbolism and the messaging, and that this is about displaying HaKadosh Baruch Hu's love to the Jewish people and therefore being a conduit for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's love and blessing to the Jewish people, as the Gemara makes clear, Yerushalmi makes it clear, that the Pasuk says there, V'samti v'shmi al bnei Yisrael v'ani avarachim, God saying, I'm the one who's blessing them, it's not really the Kohanim who are doing the blessing, it's really God who's doing the blessing, and they are the tool for it, and that's perhaps why there's such a focus on the visuals and on what is represented by the people who are involved. So all of the details that we have about the players here, perhaps this was the way to say it, is part of what's going on, that this is a display that's meant to have this dramatic impact. So we find that lifting up the hands seems to be important, as the Gemara understands from this pasuk. And it was a machlokes achronim, the Behuda and the Shlos Yaakov. In the beginning of the second chelak of the Tshuva Shlos Yaakov, he had a machlokes with the Behuda about whether this is ma'akev. Let's say you have a Kohen who's not totally healthy, and he's not able to lift up his hands. So is Nesias Kapayim ma'akev Bechas Kohen? Or together with that, they also discuss, let's say he can't stand up. Let's say you have a Kohen who can't stand, can't lift his hands, but he can otherwise be brought up there without lifting his hands, and he'll sit. So can he partake in the Berchas Kohanim? So the Behuda thought, no, he thought these dinim were ma'akev, and the Shlos Yaakov didn't think so, didn't think this was ma'akev. So some raised the question, the Sefer Menchas Kenos, the Maseches Sota, so he asked the question that if it's not so important, then some of the dinim that we have are harder to understand, that we have dinim that really focus very heavily on the role of the hands. It really does seem to be a key part, as is being derived from this pasuk. So, for example, as Tosfos Maseches Yevamos on Daf Zayin explains, that we have a din that a murderer is not able to duchen. It's a very big discussion, lahalacha, what that applies to. Does it mean only an intentional murderer? Does it mean even somebody who's brought about someone's death, let's say, with justification? A big discussion if somebody killed people in self-defense or in the army. So is he also included in this din? Like we find by David HaMelech, that he was excluded from building the Beit HaMikdash because of his presumably justified killing in war. So it could be that even if it's not the Aveira of Ritzicha, it may also be included. What about in between? What if somebody killed somebody negligently? Accidentally. So how exactly does that fit in? So that's a major discussion in Poskim. But this din that the Kohen who killed somebody shouldn't dochen, so Tosus explains, it's because the hands that killed someone, we use the expression, somebody has blood on their hands, so those bloody hands, they should not be able to serve as advocate. In Kateger Nasus Neneg, it's also the way the Gemara and Brachos sounds like, that based on the Gemara quotes a pasuk in Yeshaya, that your hands are filled with blood, so how can these bloody hands, how can they serve for this purpose? So it sounds like the hands really are playing a pretty important role. It sounds like they should be ma'akev. There is a discussion in Poskim, Shevet Alevi has the tshuva, and also Nasan Gishtet, and the tshuva is Laharis Nasan, that the Gemara in Bav Metzia, and a few places in Shas, the Gemara compares embarrassing somebody in public to killing him. Gemara compares it to Shvichos Damim. So they discuss the question, if you have a Kohen who embarrasses people in public, maybe we shouldn't let him duchen, for the same logic, the same way we don't let somebody who has killed people physically duchen, so we shouldn't let somebody who embarrasses people in public duchen either. So these great poskim, the Shevet Alevi and the Laharis Nasan, they both don't conclude that way. They don't think that that's actually true, lahalacha. that such a person isn't allowed to dochen. They don't necessarily find the comparison to be really equal. It's a whole discussion in general when that line in the Gemara appears that somebody who humiliates someone else is like Shkichus Damim. Is that really a literal comparison? How far would you go with that? So it's a big discussion throughout. And this seems to be one of the issues. Would you also apply this exclusion from Brechas Kohanim? It happens to be there are some lesser known Svarim that talk about the Halachos of Brechas Kohanim in general. Some of the Svarim, they're machmir on this question. But the Tshuvas Laharis Nasan and the Shevet Alevi, they don't come to that conclusion. But the Laharis Nasan also adds, it says that even if you were to say that Al Pidin, the Chomer Ha'isr, was actually equal to murder, still wouldn't necessarily carry over, because the whole point is the hands, Dafka, that since the hands committed murder, so these hands can't be used for Nesias Kapayim. Now, you probably could respond to that, well, isn't the speech also part of the bracha? So why don't we say that if you killed somebody with your voice, you killed somebody by embarrassing them, so then you shouldn't be able to say the bracha, because the bracha is also crucial. That's the whole discussion. We want to have to eventually get to the topic of Shemaya Kaona. Hopefully cover that and share a little bit, and we'll see there's a major discussion about whether Shemaya Kaona works for Berchas Kaonim, and that highlights the importance of the speech also. So speech and the hands are both important here. So even if you want to say that hands that were used for killing shouldn't be able to be useful for Berchas Kaonim, but the voice is also important. So if you used your voice to embarrass someone, so maybe that should also be excluded. Okay, so that's a question, but what the Horus Nostin there writes is that it's specifically talking about physical murder because of this role of the hands. So this all highlights that it does have a very significant part here. The Gemara Maseches Ksubis on Daf Chof Dalet says that if a non-Kohen would go up to Duchen, if a Zar would go up to Duchen, he's Mevatel and Aseh. The whole discussion exactly what that means. First of all, what does he have to do in order to be Mevatel the Aseh? So Paris Yosef quotes from the Sefer Mishnah Sfachanim that it means only if he does the Nesias Kapayim part. He has to actually lift his hands, because that's crucial to the definition. He has to lift his hands in order to violate this Bitul Aseh that the Gemara is talking about. Some explain the Bitul Aseh based on the Haredim. It's not a political statement. The Shita of Haredim is one of the Rishonim. The Sefer Haredim. So the Sefer Haredim has a often quoted view here. It could be there were other Rishonim who agreed as well, that the mitzvah of Berchas Kohanim is not only on the Kohen, that the mitzvah is also on the non-Kohanim in the audience. The mitzvah al ha-Yisrael lehisbarech. The mitzvah on the Kohen to give the bracha, and a mitzvah on the Yisrael to receive the bracha. So therefore, if he's going to place himself in the wrong position, he's going to join the Kohanim, so then maybe that's the issue, the Bitul Aseh, that he's missing out on his part of the play, that he should be the one receiving the bracha. We all have a part in this story. It's also related to the whole question of looking at the hands. The Shulchan Aruch HaRav understands from this pasuk that the hands dafka shouldn't be covered up with the towels because of this role. But we assume that we look away, and we shouldn't be looking at the hands. And the Svarim explain two reasons why that is. It sounds like from the Gemara and Chagiga that there'll be a negative impact. Perhaps as the Zohar explains the Shechina, and the Gemara says that the person who looks at the Berchas Kohanim is going to find himself losing his eyesight, that he's going to be dimmed because of what he's looking at. But we also have a more practical approach based on the Talmud Yerushalmi that we're worried about Hesach Hadas. The Talmud Yerushalmi says that if a Kohen has a mum on his hand, so we're worried the Fiduchim is going to be a distraction to people. So the idea that it's a distraction, and that that's something that we have to care about. Why do we have to care about a distraction? So it's a Hesach Hadas. So why can't you have a Hesach Hadas during the Berchus Kohanim? So some suggest that this is another raya for the position of the Haredim, that the Yisrael also has a role here, so he has to focus. He can't have Hesach Hadas because he needs to be able to fulfill his obligation. The Kajik Lover Rav has a fascinating tshuva. All of his tshuvas are fascinating. He has a fascinating tshuva where he uses this idea of the Charedim, the involvement of the Yisrael, to explain how we get away with it in the Chutz Laretz. How come we don't do Berachas Kohanim every day, like we're supposed to do? The Torah talks about Berachas Kohanim doesn't limit it to the Regalim. So in Chutz Laretz, most of us only do Berachas Kohanim on Yom Tov. In Eretz Yisrael, they do it every day. That seems to be what the Torah requires. So how do we not do Berachas Kohanim all the rest of the days? So the Ramah writes that Berachas Kohanim requires Simcha, and in Chutz Laretz, we don't have enough Simcha. We're all depressed living in Chutz Laretz. We're not happy enough that we're able to have Birchas Kohanim every day. And it's only Yantif. Yantif gives us an extra booster shot of Simcha. So on Yantif, we're able to do Birchas Kohanim. So basically, on Yantif, we're like a normal day in Eretz Yisrael. So every day in Eretz Yisrael, they can do it. And in Chutz Laretz, we need Yantif to bring us up to that level. So the Kajik Lavarav is a tshuva. He says, it doesn't seem like an adequate explanation that that's going to be enough to release us from the daily obligation of Berachas Kohanim. So he suggests that actually we do fulfill it on a reduced level, because since it's a part of Chazaras Ashat, so Ashat does it b'shlichus. And he, on behalf of the Kohanim, he performs some degree of the mitzvah of Berachas Kohanim. The problem is that we know that in order to be a shliach, you have to be also a part of the mitzvah. You can't have a shliach, somebody who's not involved in the mitzvah. So we don't have any insistence that whoever is davening shacharis on a daily basis is going to be a kohen. So how can the shliach tzibur necessarily serve as a shliach for the kohanim? So in that context, the Kajagov suggests that maybe that's the idea, that because we are a part of the mitzvah, because Yisraelim also have this mitzvah l'hisparech, so it's not like a situation where there's no connection between the shliach and the mitzvah. The shliach has a different role in the mitzvah, but he is a part of the mitzvah, and therefore he is able to serve as the agent of the kohanim, and to at least give us some connection to Berachas Kohanim on a daily basis, and that's how we're able to satisfy on some level the Torah's obligation, and then B'tziruf Ramah, we don't do it the whole full-blown way because we're not fully the Simcha here, but that's perhaps a combination of approaches to address it. That's the way he understood it. A very interesting idea. Hi, Ari.
Mm-hmm.
So why does it make them less involved?
Because not only are they not commanded to perform the action, they are commanded to be the recipients of the action and like the opposite side, like precisely the opposite of the overt part.
Maybe a semantic issue how you use the word opposite, because if opposite means completely different from, so then I'm not sure that it qualifies. So opposite means like the other side of the room, the other side of the equation, the opposite the door. So they're opposite in that sense. They are physically opposed. They're facing each other. But it's not opposite in the sense of being completely disconnected. So to say that you need to be in the parsha of something in order for shlichus to work, so maybe that counts. And especially consistent with the explanation we gave before, that it's not really the Kohanim, as the Gemara suggests, not really the Kohanim blessing the people. It's God blessing the people, and the Kohanim are a vehicle in order to have this display. So really, we're all playing parts. So the Kohanim are playing parts, and the Israelim are playing parts, and together we need to have this dramatic presentation. So maybe it's really not so different. Everyone has their place to stand and to perform this display. And it's really a Kadosh Baruch Hu who is transmitting the message. Now, it happens to be, it's a little longer explanation. If you want, if you look in the tshuva of the Kajik Lever, in general, and we've mentioned him from time to time, the Kajik Lever was a very creative thinker, and he drew very interesting parallels from one area of halacha to another. So I'm saying it over in kind of a general way. If you look in the actual tshuva, you see he quotes from a Russian Kedushin. He has a more specific understanding of how this level of involvement qualifies in order to justify the shlichus. But we don't even need to say it necessarily in as fancy a way as he says it. But maybe the idea is we're all a part of this display, a part of this presentation, and therefore the notion that to have the Kohen kind of represent, have the Rishat kind of represent the Kohanim blessing him, maybe it's not such a unusual idea. But either way, it's kind of a sniff. He's basically just trying to justify, he says, the Ramah's explanation. It just doesn't seem to be enough to say that that's going to explain us being completely disconnected from this Torah mitzvah. Okay, we're connected on some level, that this is enough to bring us into that parsha, and then the Ramah can be combined with it. Either way, it's a very interesting idea. We should note that this idea of lifting hands, so like we said before, it has the imagery that we're directing attention to Kadosh Baruch Hu. So we find this elsewhere in the Torah as well, that in Parshas Bishalach, so we find when the war with Amalek happened, so Moshe lifted up his hands, and that was a tool of tefillah in general, to lift up your hands as an expression of tefillah. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger, his artist, the Shulchan Aruch, and Siman Peites and Aruch Chaim, so he writes that nowadays we don't do that in our general tefillah, because the Ovdei Avodah Zarah took it over. And so that's the way they pray, so we don't do it anymore. And he compares it to the idea of a matzeva that we're not supposed to make anymore, a monument like the Avos put up. So when the Avos did it, it was beloved to God, but now the Knanim took it over, so now it's Snua, so we don't do that anymore. It's the Sifrei and Shoftim. So the Rebbe Akiva Eiger says we don't daven like that anymore, like Moshe did, because the Ovdei Avodah Zarah have taken that over. They hijacked it. So that's an idea later Svarim have a hard time with. Rav Huttner has a long piece about this in the end of his Mamarim on Purim, or the Pachri Yitzchak on Purim, that's hard to understand, that we have a notion that we're not supposed to imitate the Ovdei Avodah Zarah. So if they do something, we don't take that as part of our practice. But if we had it first, so they can postulate it by hijacking it, so if we're historically doing it, so how does it work that the Ovdei Avodah Zarah can disqualify it by their adopting it? It doesn't seem to be so easily understood. So I think perhaps the idea is that it's really all about a means to an end. And that's what the Mishnah says in Rosh Hashanah. The Mishnah talking about the hands of Moshe Rabbeinu in that context. So the Mishnah says, you know, in English we have an expression, this is not going to make or break things. So that expression comes from that Mishnah. The Mishnah says, what was going on? Moshe Rabbeinu's hands were being lifted up to Shemayim, and that's what made the Jews win the war. So the Mishnah asks, V'chiyada Shemosha Osos Mochamo Shogos Mochamo, did they make or break the war? Is that really how war is won or lost based on Moshe's hands? So the Mishnah says, no, that when the Jews were thinking about God, so then they prevailed, and when they forgot about God, so that's when they had a harder time. So when Moshe was lifting his hands up to Shemayim, it was a reminder they should think about God. And when he didn't, then they forgot about it. So basically what that conveys is this idea is a means to an end. It's not really something that we do for the essence of our tefillah. It's something that helps us to focus our attention. So it's all about what's it going to bring about. What kind of imagery is it going to evoke? So maybe what Akiva Eiger is saying is that if the Ovdei Avodah Zarah took it over, so now it presents a different image. We think about that and we associate it with other practices, so that it's going to be counterproductive. So if there was something that was inherently valuable as our Avodah, so then we wouldn't necessarily get rid of it just because Ovdei Avodah Zarah do it too. But if there's something that's supposed to help us focus, it's supposed to bring about a certain mindset, so then we get worried if that mindset gets confused, and then it may no longer be as effective as it would be, and then we would switch to something else. Okay, there are other dinim about Berachas Kohanim that are also derived from this pasuk here in Shmini, the idea of Yadav, which is written here Chaser, the Kri is Yadav, but it's written here as if it says Yado, and so the Chazal understand that he picked up his two hands as if they were one. And that's how the Hagos Maimon Hilchos Tefillah and other Mefarshim write, based on the Zohar, that the right hand should be a little bit higher than the left hand. And the pasuk concludes that following this bracha, so the pasuk concludes the Yered Then they went down from this avoda. So the Gemara in Sotah over there on Lamed Ches, the Gemara says that you see from here the calling his dochening, he should go at the time of the avoda. Basically, what the pasuk is suggesting is that the bracha is integrated into the process of the tefillah and the process of the avoda, and our tefillah is connected avoda. So therefore, it's important not just that the kohenim issue the bracha, but that they issue it in the context of the avoda. And that has all kinds of halachic ramifications about how they go up and go down. And it's also a discussion, the Sefer Mikra Eidah has a nice essay about this, about what about kohanim, this comes up a lot, but kohanim who are not otherwise a part of that service. So let's say, for example, especially for us, we do Birchas Kohanim, like you said, specifically on Yontif. So if you have Yontif Sheni, and you say you have a Israeli Kohen who's visiting, so, funny, if he was in Israel, he'd be doing every day anyway, but as somebody in America who's not observing Yontif, who's not Nekar Adin, obligating Yontif Sheni, so he is then not a part of the Berachas Kohanim, or he's not a part of the Yontif Tefillah, so that's more to the point, he's not a part of the Yontif Tefillah, so then for him to perform the Berachas Kohanim, it's an interesting discussion. We also have the practice of Kohanim coming to multiple minyanim sometimes, they daven in one minyan, and they come to another minyan also to serve as Kohanim if they don't have Kohanim for the bracha. So it's an interesting discussion, how much of an issue is that to not be participating in the tefillah. Now we had that in over Yontif, so we still have a minyan inside, a minyan outside, because of the COVID situation. So all our Kohanim were davening in the outside minyan, so they did duchening there, and then they came into the inside minyan to duchen for the inside people also. So that's a discussion as far as to what extent is it a problem to not be connected to the avoda, even though we know Kohanim can do Birchas Kohanim multiple times a day, they're not obligated to do an additional minyanim. But that's the discussion, the suggestion here that there's specifically an integration of the avoda and the Birchas Kohanim. Okay, so we'll just mention the last pasuk. You didn't think this was going to go on so long. So the last pasuk tells us, so Yavah Moshe V'Aaron Oho Moeg V'Yetu V'Yavarach Es Am V'Yerach Lo Hashem Or Kol Ha'am. So they came out and they blessed the people, and God's glory was revealed to the people. So if you look at Rashi, so Rashi tells us that the bracha that they gave, it's a familiar pasuk in Tehillim, Yinoam Hashem Elokeinu Aleinu, and the idea being, he wrote on Shetishra Shechina B'Masi Yadeichem, that we want that Shechina should dwell on everything that you do. And there's a nice discussion about this in the Sefer Ohel Moshe. He quotes from Reuven Melamed, who was the Talmud of Chesed Levenstein, that it seems a little difficult to understand why they're looking for Hashvas HaShechina. They already have Hashvas HaShechina. That's why they had the Mishkan in the first place. They already had the Mechila from the Chet Ego. So they have the Shechina. So he notes here that you see that we're not talking about the yes or no kind of question. We're talking about this either is or isn't. There's all kinds of degrees, and that we are never satisfied where we're at, even if you think, okay, we're a holy people, we have the Shechina, but we're always striving for more. We're always striving for a more absolute infusion of the Shechina and a more complete presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in everything that we do. And that's a powerful message to close on. So I wish you a good Shabbos, Parshas Shmini. When you think about all the very intense themes of Parshas Shmini, it pushes us towards a greater sensitivity to matters of Kedusha and a greater recognition. All the themes in the Parsha show us the importance of being very precise and careful in what is and what isn't required in order to enhance our Kedusha. It's all a part of this continuing effort to strive and to perfect the presence of the Shechina in our lives, and hopefully we are able to do that successfully, but to recognize that success is a continuing process. There's always more to succeed, there's always more to build and to grow, and that's what we're here to do. So hopefully we will be able to continue to strive in that direction. and we should have a meaningful and uplifting Shabbos. And I look forward, God willing, to seeing you on Sunday.
Thank you.
Have a great Shabbos.